From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in New Hampshire today outlining his plan to fight the opioid epidemic, but he's still tweeting about the Russia investigation, continuing the weekend attacks on special counsel Robert Mueller by the president and his personal lawyer, John Dowd. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle leapt up to say, let Mueller finish his work. Here's House Republican Trey Gowdy speaking on Fox News Sunday.
If you have an innocent client, Mr. Dowd, act like it. Russia attacked our country. Let Special Counsel Mueller figure that out. And if you believe, as we found, there's no evidence of collusion, you should want Special Counsel Mueller to take all the time and have all the independence he needs to do his job.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
Look, Trey Gowdy, as you know, is not going to run again. Lindsey Graham is, and he also went on TV to say, let the investigation play out. Your thoughts, first of all, on how Republicans reacted to this weekend?
Well, many Republicans are certainly frustrated with this president. They continue to not be sure what his endgame is, what he wants to do. There isn't much of a strategy going forward with them, certainly. But that said, there doesn't look like many of these Republicans are ready or willing to do anything to stop a potential Mueller firing from happening. They could write something into legislation. They certainly aren't taking steps to do that at this point. And we don't know if the president's mind is made up to do that one way or another. He could just be venting. He could be trying to scare some people. We just don't know and won't know anything until something actually happens.
Well, the president continued to do this. His frustration at the Mueller probe, he tweeted out this morning. We spoke elsewhere in the program to people in New Hampshire who said he's stepping on his own message of the opioid plan, you know, knocking it off the radar because of his tweets. But again, tweeted total witch hunt, massive conflicts of interest. This is the first time this past weekend the president has mentioned Mueller directly. You say we don't know if the president's going to fire him. He can't. The president can't. He'd have to have others at the Justice Department do it. But, you know, is there a sense of why he's changed that tactic? Does it have to do with Mueller asking for documents from Trump businesses?
Well, it's interesting. We don't know. You're right that the president hasn't really gone after Mueller directly before, but he has repeatedly dismissed the investigation as a witch hunt created by Democrats. You know, supporters of Trump's in the administration have floated Mueller, the fact that Mueller has brought Democrats on board. Trump even says that more Democrats have been brought on board himself. All of that, though, of course, is despite the fact that Mueller is a Republican. Comey was a Republican. James Comey, the fired FBI director. Apparently, Trump believes that unless you support him, you're not a real Republican.
Yeah. Just a thought on acting FBI director Andrew McCabe and his firing late Friday night. Less than a day to go before he was to retire. So in that moment, lost pensions. There's talk of him maybe being rehired somewhere by a sympathizer to get the pension back. But the Department of Justice said it fired him because of his lack of candor about a contact with a Wall Street Journal reporter. Do we know more about those contacts?
Well, we know that Attorney General Jeff Sessions said that McCabe was fired after a recommendation from the Inspector General's office and what's known as the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility. It's essentially the ethics division of the FBI for what you said, the lack of candor under oath and on multiple occasions. Now, that stems from what's believed to be an unauthorized disclosure or what Trump would call a leak to a Wall Street Journal reporter and lying about it. We should say we have not seen this report yet, nor has anyone else, which is what has some lawmakers upset given the timing. The context, like you said, is that McCabe was set to retire, would have been Sunday, and would have received his pension. Now he likely won't.
Yeah. Well, boy, it got ugly fast. The president celebrated. He tweeted out Andrew McCabe fired. Great day for the hardworking men and women of the FBI. But former CIA chief John Brennan tweeted to the president in part, when the full extent of your venality becomes known, you will take your rightful place as a disgraced demagogue in the dustbin of history. You know, this is ugly.
That's really ugly. And, you know, someone like John Brennan is a pretty low-key guy. That's not something that – he doesn't bring that kind of fire to a lot of discussion. So that does make you stand up and listen
and
a little bit.
Yeah.
We should note that McCabe, in defense of himself, said in a statement that he didn't lie. He said that he was truthful. And when he thought that about what he misunderstood in his context, he went back and tried to correct the record. Now, we don't know what the specifics are of what he's talking about, but McCabe also said said he believes the investigation is politically motivated. He said he thinks that the administration is deliberately out to get him, tried to come up with something through this investigation. And he said it was, quote, driven by the president himself, who he believes wanted him out, since he said that he could back up some of what FBI Director James Comey's accounts were and to strip him of that pension.
Look, Domenico, this morning, for all the early morning what they call cut-ins, reporters standing outside the White House noted that a lot of lights were on. There seemed to be more lights than usual early this morning, indicating maybe people have come in to try to, you know, figure all this out. And there seems to be a disagreement between Trump's personal lawyer, John Dowd, who has, you know, called for the investigation to end, and Ty Cobb, the White House lawyer, insisting Donald Trump is not considering firing Mueller, ending the investigation. What's your sense of what's going on inside the White House right now?
Well, first of all, just because the lights are on doesn't mean
anybody's home.
Right.
Okay.
There is a disagreement between some of these attorneys from the president, John Dowd, who said that he's actually praying that Attorney General Rod Rosenstein will follow the brilliant and courageous example of the FBI's office and bring an end to the Russia collusion. There was some question whether or not he was speaking for himself or for the president. He initially said he was speaking for the president. The White House said it was unauthorized. And then he later said that, no, he was just talking for himself. But look, just look at what the president has to say. He himself called the investigation a witch hunt, spoke out directly about it on Saturday, said it should have never been started, and called out Mueller himself.
Okay. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. It's just Monday. We'll see how the week unfolds. Domenico, thank you.
Let's see. Thank you.
And it has been 6 months to the day since a devastating earthquake killed hundreds of people in Mexico City and left thousands more without a place to live or work. But after months of cleaning up and rebuilding, there are questions about how effective the recovery effort has been. KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau Chief Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
Aulas Uno.
At the Tec de Monterrey in Mexico City, one of Mexico's most elite private colleges, students read memories of the surrounding buildings that will be knocked down soon.
La historia del campus Ciudad de México en Tlalpan inició en 1990.
The September 19 earthquake damaged most of the facilities, including the one where Here and Now hosted a live show last year. But university leaders say they're determined to rebuild the school and make it one of the best colleges in the Americas. Alfredo Pompa is Tec de Monterrey's campus vice president.
De seguro la atesorarán en su vida como una de las mejores enseñanzas.
Pompa says the surviving students will come to see the earthquake experience as one of the most important learning episodes of their lives. The ceremony ends with cheers, but off campus, some people wonder if the university was negligent. Among them, Juan Carlos Alvarez. His son, also named Juan Carlos, was one of the five Tech students killed by a collapsing pedestrian bridge during the earthquake.
Le surge quitar toda la evidencia de la mala construcción.
Alvarez says Tech is trying to erase evidence. He says the bridges that killed his son were poorly built, violating the city's construction code. And he's filed a lawsuit to prove that, but
está completamente congelada. No ha habido ningún avance. No hay nada.
The dispute's been frozen, he says, and suspects the university is protected by the authorities. Officials at the Tec de Monterrey could not make anyone available to be interviewed for this story. Meanwhile, people have been arrested in Mexico City for allegedly building without the proper permits or specifications. But other cases are in limbo. Near rowdy Tlalpan Avenue sits one of many improvised shelters for earthquake victims, a tent camp on a basketball court. About 40 people live here, and one of them, Nick Teja Brito.
Sí, porque sí es muy, muy triste, muy desgastante estar cansado. No.
Brito feels sad and exhausted. She's been waiting for the government to repair the damaged public housing complex where she lived. And despite the uncertainty, Brito says she won't abandon her family's treasured apartment. In the hipster neighborhood of Condesa, construction workers finished cleaning the site where an office building collapsed. The city says it will build an earthquake memorial here. But where the funding is coming from, that is unclear. And so is the fate of millions of dollars donated from all over the world for the earthquake's reconstruction.
I think you have to assume that it's either ineptitude or corruption that's keeping some of these funds from being disbursed 6 months after the tragedy.
That's Laura Moody, an Arizonan living in Mexico City with a master's in public policy from the Kennedy School of Government. Moody's been helping rebuild poor neighborhoods that are still struggling with the earthquake's destruction.
I think it's just sad. It's just terribly, terribly sad that we haven't figured out a way to provide people what they need, their basic needs of food and shelter 6 months later.
The commission to reconstruct the city has changed leadership 5 times after multiple resignations. And while the citizens try to move beyond the catastrophe, a new opportunity for change approaches. Federal and local elections in July. For Here and Now, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
First Lady Melania Trump is meeting with tech companies this week to talk about preventing online harassment, the newest version of an old problem, bullying. And we're going to be talking about that issue all week, starting with our guest today, Dorothy Espelage, professor of psychology at the University of Florida, and Nadine Connell, director of the Center for Crime and Justice Studies at the University of Texas, Dallas. They spoke with Jeremy Hobson.
When people hear about bullying, some people might think, oh, those kids will grow up to be fine. You know, this is just something that happens. What do we know? What does the research tell us about the lifelong effect, if there is one, of being bullied? I'll start with you, Dorothy.
Yeah, so when we think about being victimized chronically through bullying, we know from the research that decades later, maybe 30 years later, if you're chronically victimized, you will have a full-blown diagnosis of major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder. So it's serious consequences for the victims. We also know that those kids that engage in high rates of bullying through childhood and adolescence actually go on to become much more kind of skilled in their aggressive behaviors, and that their bullying turns into homophobic name-calling, sexual harassment. And as we track these kids into high school, they actually perpetrate more teen dating violence in their dating relationships. So it really is this continuum of perpetration. So it's not just that bullying is a cause for concern. It's the type of aggression that follows.
Nadine, your thoughts on the long-term effects of bullying?
Well, so I want to add to what Dorothy has just said about the bullying perpetrators is not only, as she mentioned, do we see these later aggressive behaviors in high school, but we have actually been able to follow up with self-identified bullies into later adulthood, and they are more likely to engage in higher rates of criminal offending. We're not just talking about it all goes away after school age or after high school, but it continues on into patterns of adulthood that can be really dangerous, problematic, and costly for society, which is why this is such an important area to study and to understand.
And so what's the start of the cycle? Why does somebody become a bully in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. We know a little bit, but not a lot, or not as much as we would like to. I can speak to some of the work that we've done, again, looking at more delinquent populations, which speaks to a variety of different reasons. In our research, we found that childhood trauma could actually have an impact in later bullying perpetration. So more traumatic events spoke to the need for earlier intervention.
Yeah, certainly we know that it's complex, right? So there's not just one predictor, but we know that there's individual characteristics. Kids that engage in high rates of bullying tend to have lots of anger. They have difficulty in regulating their emotions. They may come from families in which they witness violence. They may be in schools where the adults bully one another and role modeling that behavior. We do know from our work that by early adolescence, if you hang out with kids that bully, you will become more like them. It's kind of a birds of a feather flock together. So we do really see it as a complex interaction between my individual characteristics, my family context, the school context, and then certainly society, as we see these types of behaviors being modeled on the television. So all of these together place you at a risk. We're seeing some of these mean and cruel behaviors emerge in preschool playgroups. So we do know that it's something that we need to intervene and stop early, but we need to intervene in different ways to be able to address those individual characteristics that place kids at risk, talking with families, creating safe spaces in schools where bullying is not seen as a positive thing. So it's a very complex problem. Unfortunately, our solutions have been too simple, and we are having challenges in reducing bullying in our schools, in our communities.
And how much has it changed because of online cyberbullying? How much has that changed the way that people bully, how many people are being bullied, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly the flavor of it has changed. And so when I was younger, decades ago, when I left school, any issues I had at school stayed at school. Here it follows them. We do know from the national data, however, that the online bullying, about 7% of kids report experiencing that on a regular basis. But we know face-to-face ranges from 15 to 20%. So the approach is certainly that social media has changed things, has had us think about our intervention programs differently. But certainly we need to recognize that kids are still engaging these behaviors face-to-face at school.
I don't want to make this segment about politics, but you can't really talk about cyberbullying without talking about President Trump. Is he having an impact as far as you can tell?
We are certainly at a time where there is a greater spectrum of behaviors that appear to be appropriate, especially when it comes to social media and being online, than used to be in the past. And it would be silly to presume that students and young people don't notice that and don't act accordingly.
Absolutely. And I'll add to that, we spend a lot of time in the schools since the election, and it is very, very clear that boys engaging in sexual harassment are defending their behaviors by pointing to the president.
Hmm. One of the storylines that we have seen over the last many years is that when there is a school shooting, sometimes people say, oh, well, that person who opened fire on his fellow students was bullied, and that led to what happened. What do you think when you hear that?
I had someone call me and say that exact comment after the shooting in Parkland. And my immediate question was, well, what else do you know about him?
Meaning that that can't be the only reason.
Absolutely.
And I can add to that in part because we are undertaking the first comprehensive data collection of all school shootings that have happened in the United States. And I think when we look at those students in previous school shooting events, such as at Columbine, such as in Jonesboro, and we take a look because there have been claims made that they were victims of bullying, those claims don't hold up to the level that we would expect. It seems that victims of bullying are much more likely to internalize. You know, Dorothy mentioned major depressive disorder, anxiety, things that do not include harm to others. And that is not to say that there aren't some individuals who do lash out as a result of their experiences, but it is much too complex to suggest that bullying is the only reason or is the most important reason as to why somebody decides to bring a gun to a school. And in fact, in many cases, several of the individuals have turned out to be bullying themselves, bullying other students. So not even so much a victim as much as possibly a perpetrator.
If there is a parent listening to this who thinks that their child is being bullied, what would you tell them to do?
You know, if you're a parent and hearing that your child is being bullied is probably going to be a very painful and one of the worst things that you can hear. And there are lots of things that a parent can do. One is to acknowledge their child's experiences and feelings about the situation, because it really is something that can be very upsetting to a child, and we don't want to minimize that. The other thing that they can do is talk to teachers, but also talk to your child about finding positive spaces for them and a place where they feel like they belong, and having them be part of the solution. I think sometimes as parents, we want to protect our child, and so we tell our children how to fix something instead of letting them tell us what they think is best. And when it comes to bullying in school dynamics, students understand those social relationships better than we as adults do many times. And so it's important to empower your student to help figure out solutions in ways that would make them feel good about how to handle the situation.
Yeah, and I would add to that, I think that oftentimes I hear from parents that they go to the school, they'll tell the school does nothing. And so the parents that are listening here, keep good records of when you go to the school. Really do understand your rights as a parent and the rights of your children. But I would have them take really copious notes and track the ways in which they've been trying to get help from the school.
So let's talk about solutions. What is the one thing that you would say could be done to reduce the amount of bullying out there? I'll start with you, Dorothy.
Yeah, so I want everybody to understand that we're not doing a really good job in reducing bullying. In the best case scenarios in many countries outside of the United States, best case scenario, they're reducing bullying by 20 to 23%. So I think that, you know, we take a real kind of holistic approach. I do school-based interventions where we teach kids empathy and perspective taking and ways in which to manage conflict and nonviolent strategies. But we also have to train the teachers and the administrators to be responsive when there are reports of bullying. We also want to take what we call as a school climate improvement process. We know very strongly that when there is a positive school climate where the teachers get along and the kids feel safe, there's less bullying, there's less sexual harassment. And so we have to focus on understanding, giving kids skills, and placing them in schools where they feel safe such that bullying is deterred.
We as adults do have the power to set the norms and the behavioral expectations for students. And it's really up to us to make sure that we are not only doing that, but we're promoting the positive behavior and we are dealing with the negative behavior so that students know there are consequences and that it matters and that how we treat people matters.
That's Nadine Connell, who is director of the Center for Crime and Justice Studies at the University of Texas, Dallas, and Dorothy Espelage, professor of psychology at the University of Florida. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it is the middle of March. Taxes are due in less than a month. I am sorry to remind you of that. But look, it's also a good time of year to get all of your finances in order, a kind of financial spring cleaning, if you will. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. And Jill, really, do you do this, a financial house cleaning every spring?
First of all, this combines like the two things I love to do. I'm a huge cleaner. Like I'm sitting here holding my Dyson in one hand. And I love like my financial life being neat and tidy. So it's a beautiful marriage of two things I love.
Yes, it is. So let's start with taxes. If it's a perfect world and we've all filed our returns, which I'm sure we have not, what is it that you can get rid of from last year? What should you keep and for how long?
This is actually one of the most common questions that I field during tax season, which is how long do I need to keep everything? Because there's different people who said 3 years, 6 years, 7 years. But, you know, the IRS actually has up to 7 years to audit your returns if they suspect you made a mistake. I really do recommend that you live and die by that 7 year number. I know. I hear you're groaning. And
a lot
you're
of
rolling.
Paper.
Yeah, a lot of paper. But you know what? A lot of tax preparers now actually have electronic copies that they will maintain for you. And so that's possible. I will say that all that supporting documentation that really does take up all the pain in the
like
neck
the
part,
receipts from
right,
like the gas station or something.
That you have to keep also. I'm so sorry.
Can you digitize that?
You could. I mean, obviously you could scan it, upload it, put it on a thumb drive, all those things. But this is the one area where, you know, if you are a pack rat, you probably will be well served in the tax area.
Well, I love to clean, just like you. But I, for some weird reason, I keep credit card statements for probably way too long. I keep utility bills for like 6-7 months before I get around to throwing them away. Am I being stupid? Am I being
I would never call you stupid. I would say that you can just fire up that shredder and get rid of it. Because, I mean, credit card bills are interesting because if you need some proof of purchase or maybe you made a charitable donation, you put it on your credit card, yes, keep that particular bill. But in general, unless you need that thing, that item, then just shred this bill after 45 days. And you know, again, the utilities, even worse. I mean, honestly, if you've paid it, you're fine.
Yeah.
And very rarely is somebody actually saying, oh, gee, you know, did you pay your utility bill? I have proof.
Well, they'll tell you if you didn't pay it, by
exactly,
the way.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Look, I know your spring cleaning checklist also includes consolidating accounts. I want to ask you about this. Say you have a retirement account from an old job. It's been sitting around for years, not doing anything. You can't contribute it to it. Is it really important to roll it over into a new one?
you know, is it important? Is it going to hurt you not to? No, it's not going to hurt you. But I will say that those orphan accounts often don't get enough attention. And that means that they're sort of hanging out there. You haven't actually managed that account. You haven't looked at it in a while. So one of the reasons I love actually consolidation is that it makes it easier to manage. It makes it more likely that you're going to rebalance all of your money at once. And I would even say that for some people who have a lot of different bank accounts for some weird reason, sometimes when you consolidate your bank accounts, you can get some free benefits. You get up over a minimum and you get rid of charges. So take a look at consolidating those accounts.
All right. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you very much. I need a shredder, Jill.
Oh, well, I'm going to get you one for the holidays.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Cambridge Analytica, the company based in Britain but founded by Steve Bannon and Republican donor Robert Mercer, is facing backlash from lawmakers for mining the sites of unsuspecting Facebook users, then using that data in the 2016 Trump campaign and sharing it with Russians. But Cambridge Analytica is also facing a lawsuit from one of those users, David Carroll, a professor at the New School's Parsons School of Design. He wants to know how they came to the conclusions they did about him, and did they target him because of what they found out about him? David Carroll joins us now. And Professor, Cambridge Analytica's claim was that it could identify the personalities of voters and influence their behavior. Now, the company asked some Facebook users for information, but then scraped up much more from them, from friends and family, which is how 50 million users got scooped up. Last year, you used a British protection law to ask Cambridge Analytica, again, its office is there, to provide the data it had on you. It did. What did you find?
It was a revelation just to receive it, to just see it there in black and white in an Excel spreadsheet. So I got my voter registration file and then a tab of the election results in my district, which was mostly accurate, incomplete, and then a panel called Models, which had 10 political issues ranked, and then my registered partisanship, my computed partisanship, and the prediction of my likelihood to vote.
Okay, let me ask. I'm looking, by the way, and we'll post the list of those models: national debt importance, how important it was to you, gun rights importance, education importance. But then also, you just said something about computer partisanship.
Sure. So it has my registered partisanship, and then what seems to be a sort of predicted partisanship. And my best guess of this is that they're trying to find people who are registered as a Democrat but willing to vote Republican, for example.
Okay. Well, data mining companies do this all the time. We're going to put aside the spat between Facebook and Cambridge Analytica now. You know, Facebook has suspended Cambridge Analytica and its parent company, Strategic Communication Laboratories. Cambridge Analytica says they did nothing wrong. We'll put that aside. How do they come to these conclusions about you? And are they right in some of the more subjective ones?
It's really hard for me to assess. That's part of the challenge here, is there's not enough information to understand what they've provided and certainly how they arrived at it. The unique thing about my ranking is the way it ranks gun rights. It's ranked seemingly pretty high.
Yeah, number two.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is understood as gun rights or gun control. The language is not clear.
Well, why does that concern you?
Well, in the case of this, it's like I can't understand this and I should be able to understand it because it's really characterizing my beliefs, my ideology, and it's done so without my knowledge or permission.
Right.
So I want to understand why they think this about me and then how that potentially affected the messages that I saw during the primaries and the general election.
Well, tell us more about that. Like what would you be concerned about?
Everything. Everything I saw on Facebook and social media, even television. I know that people's set-top boxes can be targeted to them as a household. So the ability for marketers and advertisers to target us as individuals is extremely powerful. And I don't think the general public has a clear understanding of how it works.
Well, marketers have been doing this, but you're talking about political marketers, and you want to know if maybe you were targeted with messages that falsely or with exaggerated information targeted Hillary Clinton, candidate Clinton. You know, you want to know How much was I being targeted because of my views?
Yeah. There's been reports that, for example, Bernie Sanders supporters in Brooklyn were targeted. So even though I'm not in a battleground district, we know that there's a chance we were still targeted. So I feel like we have a right to know.
Yeah. And also a right to know exactly what they saw when they put together this profile of you. You know, Facebook searches. We were saying in our office, we're constantly doing Facebook searches that have nothing to do with what we believe in, you know, but it's just our work. So how would that be interpreted? This is what you're trying to get, this information from them in your lawsuit. But isn't there also a question of, this is the time we live in. If you're on Facebook, maybe you should just accept and know that people are going to be data mining you.
What's interesting, what I've learned about this, is there's another way of seeing this on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. They understand data protection as a civil rights issue, as a sense of personal dignity. So I think we need to look at their laws and why they have regulators for information. And I think we need to look at this superior model, which in this case has potentially protected the privacy of all registered American voters by the sheer weirdness that our voter data was processed in the United Kingdom.
In other words, you're saying, oddly, it's a British law that allowed you to ask Cambridge Analytica for the information on you. It protected you as an American voter by a British law.
Yes, the weird irony that our former colonizer has unintentionally perhaps protected our privacy of the voting booth.
That's David Carroll, a professor at the New School, who's brought a lawsuit against the political data firm Cambridge Analytica. Professor, we will stay tuned. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
And by the way, we reached out to Cambridge Analytica and haven't received a response. But in Mother Jones in December, the company called Carroll's claims unfounded and said they take data privacy seriously. Let's turn now to Austin, Texas, on edge after an explosion late last night sent two young men to the hospital. This is the fourth explosion in Austin in less than a month, two of them fatal. Police say the men tripped a wire to a device while walking down the sidewalk. At a press conference today, Interim Police Chief Brian Manley was asked when authorities would start calling this string of bombings domestic terrorism.
We are clearly dealing with what we expect to be a serial bomber at this point, based on the similarities between now what is the fourth device. And again, as we look at this individual and the pattern and what we're looking at here, we will have to determine if we see a specific ideology behind this or something that will lead us, along with our federal partners, to make that decision.
Matt Largie is managing editor for KUT in Austin. Matt, this explosion comes after those three package bombs. As we said, killed two, injured two. They detonated when victims tried to open them. They were left outside their homes. They brought them in. This is a tripwire. What are police saying about that?
Yeah, not a lot of detail yet. But they've said that there were similarities between the bomb that exploded last night and the three earlier this month. And they did point to this tripwire again as indicating a new level of sophistication in the bomber's methods and kind of a change in the way that they're targeting victims.
Yeah.
As you said, the first three were left on people's front porches, but this one was on the street where just any random person could come across it.
Right. And the first one, it was noted that these were in black or Hispanic neighborhoods. These two young men walking were white, so there's been an expansion that way. And this seems to be a someone, if it's a person who already had a sophistication, because it's, you know, bombs, it's hard to work with them without exploding them before you deliver them. So some knowledge. Mm-hmm. On Saturday, police arrested a 26-year-old for emailing a bomb threat. Now, South by Southwest, which ended yesterday, canceled the Roots concerts because of that threat. Are police saying whether, you know, he's a suspect?
Yeah, they've said that he's not connected.
Ah.
At this point, there's been no warning before any of the other bombings, and there was nothing found at the music venue that this guy threatened. So, no, at this point, they don't see a connection there.
And the police also reached out to whoever might be behind the bombings. Again, here's Chief Manley.
I will reach out to the suspect or suspects and ask that you contact us, ask that you reach out to us, communicate with us so that we can put this to an end. There are innocent people getting hurt in this community, and it needs to come to a stop.
And Matt, they seem to be saying, tell us what you want.
That's right. Yeah, he said the same thing yesterday at a press conference where they announced an increase in the reward. And they basically said, tell us what you want. We'll listen. And then within a few hours, there was another bombing.
Yeah. Boy, people have, the nerves have got to be on edge there.
Oh, yeah. People are freaked out. This is the fourth bombing now. The MO has changed. It seems more random. Police are warning people to be on the lookout every day for backpacks and bags and packages and everything. So I think everybody's feeling pretty on edge as this continues into the third week of these bombings.
Are they even telling people to stay home? I mean, I don't know how a city can be brought to a halt.
Well, yeah, that's right. In the neighborhood where the explosion happened last night, they actually locked down that neighborhood.
Quite something. Matt Largy, managing editor for KUT there in Austin, Texas. Matt, thank you.
You bet.
Physicist Stephen Hawking spent a lifetime teaching us about the universe we live in. He also taught us about the terrible disease he suffered with for most of that life. ALS paralyzed the scientist, robbed him of the use of his muscles, but left his mind untouched. When Hawking died last week at the age of 76, people were left wondering how he lived for decades after being diagnosed. Steve Perrin is president and chief scientific officer at the ALS Therapy Development Institute. He joins us now in the studio. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
So Stephen Hawking was diagnosed with ALS in 1963. He was 21 years old, and people thought he wasn't going to live but just a couple of years. How rare is his longevity?
It's very rare. I mean, he's certainly an extreme outlier. I mean, 10% of ALS patients can live 10 years or longer. But somebody like Stephen Hawking is certainly an outlier.
And it's far more common to have it develop late in life.
That is more common. It's not uncommon to see people in their 20s diagnosed today. Diagnosis has gotten better and better over the years, so it's not unusual to see people diagnosed in their 20s and 30s anymore.
And what's the life expectancy typically?
It's highly variable. We love to throw out language that it's 3 to 5 years, but it really depends upon a lot of factors, many of which we don't understand, but quality of care, it plays a big role.
Why does it appear in some people earlier?
We don't know. Huh. Much like we don't know why Stephen Hawking was such an outlier. I mean, he was a theoretical physicist, and we're now into theoretical neurobiology here. Mm. Again, quality of care makes a big difference.
That. Yeah. You know, even Stephen Hawking said that it was the quality of his care that he credited for helping him live so long.
Absolutely. The earlier a person that has been diagnosed with ALS accepts the disease, which is quite challenging, and decides to intervene, the better their quality of life is going to be and the longer they're going to live.
Talk about that. I mean, what kind of care are we talking about?
Well, somebody like Stephen Hawking had access to 24/7 care for most of his life, mm-hmm. which a lot of ALS patients do not. And, you know, that really helps with getting in front of things like opportunistic infections in particular. So good quality health care, early feeding tube to prevent the weight loss that patients experience. But it's that 24-hour care from a caregiver, professional nursing staff that really helps people like Dr. Hawking or Augie Nieto live longer with their disease.
And who's he?
Augie's the chairman of ALS TDI. He was the pioneer of the fitness industry and, ironically enough, was diagnosed with ALS about 10 years ago as well.
And he's outlived the expectations.
Absolutely. A couple of standard deviations longer.
You know, this disease is so terrible. I think most Americans know it because of Lou Gehrig, you know, the famous baseball player who was diagnosed and had to leave his career at its height. Just hearing you talk about the care that is needed when you're diagnosed with this, it's a bad disease, you know?
It's a terrible disease, and it's a spectrum of diseases that we call ALS, but motor neuron disease affects and presents in people in very different ways. And that's why it's a spectrum of diseases. For instance, in the genetic form of the disease, with the same mutations, you could have one sibling show complete motor function loss and no cognitive deficits. The exact same mutation in a sibling or a cousin could cause serious cognitive dysfunction and less motor function problems. So ALS is definitely a spectrum of motor neuron diseases that we just call ALS because we really don't understand much of the underlying biology.
Because Stephen Hawking was such an outlier in the disease, did he teach us something about it?
He taught us to not let a disease like ALS conquer you. He had an incredibly productive life post-diagnosis. And there are ways, and as technologies are being developed, like we have a precision medicine program that's helping to dive through patient heterogeneity, but as communication devices get more sophisticated and as we develop tools like exoskeletons to help with movement, ALS does not affect most people's cognitive function. You can live an incredibly productive life, as did Dr. Hawking.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. When you say patient heterogeneity, you mean every patient is very different, just like Dr. Hawking was.
Absolutely. If there was 100 newly diagnosed patients in the room here today, we don't understand or could not predict which ones are going to lose their battle with the disease 9 months post-symptoms and which ones might be an outlier like Stephen Hawking.
Hmm. Well, here is Stephen Hawking, speaking of inspiration, getting involved in the now famous Ice Bucket Challenge for ALS back in 2014.
Because I had pneumonia last year, it would not be wise for me to have a bucket of cold water poured over me. But my children, Robert, Lucy, and Tim, gallantly volunteered to take the challenge for me. I urge everyone to donate to the MNDA to eliminate this terrible disease.
So a cure did not come in time for Stephen Hawking, but people like you are working on a cure. Where are we?
So we're excited. We're finally starting to really understand what might be the intervention points to first slow down the disease. Cure is a challenging word, but if we could slow down the disease enough in a newly diagnosed person to watch their kids go to college, watch their grandkids get born, that's going to be an amazing game changer. And we're finally getting there with things like gene therapies, antisense technologies, changing the way the immune system attacks one's nerves in the body. Those are all exciting opportunities that are starting to move into the clinic for patients with ALS.
Stephen Perrin, President and Chief Scientific Officer for the ALS Therapy Development Institute. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Really appreciate it, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.